online, on smart speakers, and on Listen Again. This is Food FM.
The Drinking Hour with David Kermode in partnership with Club Onologique. The world through the lens of wine and spirits.
This week, the story of Marlborough. Half a century since its first vines were planted, it's New Zealand's biggest wine region. Its distinctive Sauvignon Blanc, a smash hit around the world. So what's behind the success? How is it special? What else shines in this sunny part of the South Island? And what's next for Marlborough? Such is its enormous impact on the wine world that it seems improbable that vines were only planted on what was previously pasture in the north of New Zealand's South Island a little over 50 years ago. Those vines were not Sauvignon Blanc, and though the story sounds apocryphal, a number of them were actually planted upside down. Half a century later, Marlborough is New Zealand's wine powerhouse, by far its biggest region, celebrated for a distinctive and different style of Sauvignon Blanc, which, at the time of its launch into the UK in the late 1980s, caused an absolute sensation. I've travelled to the region to meet some of its key winemakers. Later, we'll hear from Stuart McLennan and Heather Stewart at St. Clair, Cloudy Bay's Daniel Sorrell, Matt Thompson at Blank Canvas, and Natalie Christensen from Yealands. But before we hear from them, here's Oz Clark, OBE, on the moment the wine world woke up to what Marlborough had to offer.
So Oz, Marlborough, Sauvignon Blanc, you tasted a wine at a New Zealand tasting and your wine world changed forever.
It was, oh gosh, I absolutely remember this. It was Montana, which is now Brancott Estate, but it used to be called Montana. Their 1983 Sauvignon Blanc from Marlborough. And I was an actor at the time. I was doing the BBC Shakespeare's. And someone had, one of the leading actors had been out on the town the night before and failed to make rehearsal. So the rehearsals were cancelled. And I knew that this is serendip for you. I knew there was a tasting on at New Zealand House. And I knew it was on the 17th floor. At the bottom of the Haymarket in London, with everyone says it's the best view in London. So I thought, well, at least I can go along and try and get into that tasting. And the floor, the view will be wonderful, even if the wines are disgusting. And I went in, and I absolutely remember it. There, 17th floor, I went in, table on the left, third wine, I think it was the third wine along, 1983, Sauvignon Blanc from New Zealand. And I had never tasted any wine with such piercing, thrilling, exhilarating, exuberant fruit, a mixture of astonishing acidity, like the freshest of limes, like the greenest of green peppers, and like the crunchiest of Granny Smith apples, but also massive fruit, extra fruit, like peaches and passion fruit, all of these things, pleasure. And in 1984, whenever that was, wine wasn't much fun. No, I don't think I'd ever tasted a wine before which had fun written all over it. I don't think I'd ever tasted a wine before which had "I'm a bloody good drink" written all over it. And in a way, that's what New Zealand did through an astonishing mixture of mistakes and cheapskate decisions and curious happenstance down in the South Island of New Zealand, which everybody said, "Oh, you can't bloody grow grapes down there, no, you know, and the soil's no bloody good, the sheep starve on it, and it's too cold, the apples struggle." All this stuff was going on. That's an Australian accent, by the way, the Kiwis will tell you. But because the land was ridiculously cheap, they went and planted way over 1,000 hectares, 2,500, 3,000, 4,000 acres. They just said, right, we'll plant all this land. And the whole objective was to make medium sweet, sparkling wine for a couple of dollars a bottle. But for some reason, the guide who planted it said, any grapes, I don't care what you got, just send them down, I'll plant them. Half the grapes he planted were red, were Cabernet Sauvignon. He planted half his grapes upside down. He knew so little about it. There was one patch which they sent down some Sauvignon Blanc grapes, some Sauvignon Blanc vines, I mean, and they planted them there. And they then took in the grapes, which for some, presumably they'd planted the right way up, and they hadn't got any winemakers and they hadn't got any equipment. But luckily in New Zealand is an area which is a dairy country. So they got some old dairy vats and they pulled out the bit in the middle that stops the milk turning into butter, and just filled it up with grape juice. They said, we haven't got any winemakers, but don't worry, guys who are dairy engineers, they're all about keeping stuff really clean. So the wines were basically made by dairy engineers in old dairy vats. And perhaps because they weren't winemakers, they produced a wine of absolute purity, because they didn't follow the old rules of the old winemakers and rip all the wonderful fruit out of the wine. They just treated it as though it was cow's milk, and it had to be kept as pure and as clean as possible. And of course, you had land which had never grown a damn thing before. I mean, the sheep literally did starve on it. And you basically had a pure virgin land producing pure virgin fruit in a wonderful climate, which we discovered now is in a rain shadow. So it's not warm, but the rain is kept off by the mountains all around. So you get sunshine, but the temperature's cold, which of course is absolute nirvana for white wine grapes, particularly. If you can have cool conditions but sunshine, that is fabulous. The cool conditions keep the acidity and the freshness in your grapes. The sunshine ripens the grapes. So you manage to get this remarkable thing, which Marlborough Sauvignon virtually invented, which was high acid plus high ripeness. And that meant that you had a wine which was the great radical wine. It was the destroyer of tradition. It was the people's wine. It was a democratic wine for once, because everybody you gave a glass of Sauvignon Blanc from New Zealand to in those days, they could describe it. Give them a glass of Bordeaux. Give them a glass of Chablis. Give them a glass of Chianti. They can't describe it. There's nothing to describe. There's sort of all kinds of flim-flam and whimsy about it, what it might or might not taste like. Give them a glass of New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc from Marlborough, and someone says lime juice, and someone says green peppers, and someone says asparagus, and someone says passion fruit, and someone says peaches, and they're all of them right, because they're all in there. And it was just wonderful that you could have a wine which is a bloody good drink, just like the best gin and tonic is a bloody good drink. The best glass of pale ale, nice and cool on a sunny afternoon, is a bloody good drink. And you didn't have to know anything more about wine at all, except to say, can I have another glass of that Sauvignon Blanc stuff from Marlborough in New Zealand?
Oz Clark reflecting on the story of Marlborough Sauvignon Blanc, and there's more of that in his latest book, Oz Clark's Story of Wine. Among those early pioneers in Marlborough were Neil and Judy Ibbotson, viticulturalists who established vines in Marlborough in the late 1970s before launching their own brand, St. Clair, 30 years ago. The estate has gone on to build a strong reputation, winning a host of awards, and I met with two of the winemaking team there, white winemaker Heather Stewart and senior winemaker Stuart McLennan, and he introduced the estate.
St. Clair family estate, owned by the Ibbotson family, growers in Marlborough since 1978. First wines produced by St. Clair in 1995. Sauvignon Blanc is where we hang our hat, so to speak. We make a number of varietals here in sunny Marlborough, but Sauvignon is dear to our hearts. Yes.
And Heather, just talk about how you weren't there at the time, but how Marlborough Sauvignon Blanc became the kind of phenomenon that it is.
We first planted Sauvignon Blanc or vines commercially in Marlborough 50 years ago, but it was dominated then by Müller Thurgau. And I think in a lot of cases it was quantity over quality. And when Sauvignon Blanc vines were commercially available in New Zealand and grown in Marlborough, it really took off. I think the first ones were tasted by a few key people in London, and those wines were taken to the London Wine Trade Fair. And I think pretty much at first taste, those did really well, were getting awarded medals, and New Zealand wine growers really were quite instrumental in pushing that over, particularly in the UK and Europe, and it's just flourished from there.
We've heard from the great Oz Clark about those first London tastings and this new taste sensation. What do you think it is, Stuart, that makes Marlborough Sauvignon Blanc so appealing to punters?
Marlborough Sauvignon is a unique wine in that it speaks abundantly clearly about its place. The terroir here is unique. Growing grapes in New Zealand, there's a special character. I mean, terroir gets talked about a lot, and soil is ultimately very important. What sometimes gets forgotten is in terroir is atmosphere, is air, is the air above which constitutes most of the carbon in a plant and the plant material. So I think the New Zealand, the cleanliness, the pureness that's is here in New Zealand, I think that comes through clearly in the wines, and Sauvignon Blanc is a great vessel for expressing that.
For someone who hasn't been here, Heather, just describe for us, if you could paint a picture, just of what Marlborough's like.
We have the Marlborough Sounds here, which are beautiful sounds with a really expansive, rugged coastline. And so that's beautiful. That's only 20 minutes from where we are here in the wine growing region. It's a valley with the Wairau River travelling up from the mountains right out to the coast. And we're very coastal here. But we're in the valley floor here, and we've got beautiful hill ranges to the south and to the north of us, which envelop Marlborough. And we have grapes growing into those foothills as well.
Mm. And it's a beautiful, sunny, light, bright place. And that is playing a really key role in some of the phenolic elements of the grapes here. In kind of layman's terms, Stuart, just explain how that's important.
Yeah, it's a big part of the style of the wines that come out of Marlborough is that structural makeup and what holds the wines firmly in place. Certainly the ripeness that we can obtain through Marlborough's kind of unique growing climate, certainly the striking sunlight, but as well the really cold nights, which holds the acidity in place, which allows for a longer ripening season to really develop some of those characters. But things like pyrazines, things like thiols, very crucial in the spectrum of flavors that we see from the wines. And those are held in place, pyrazines, thiols, they're held in place by a ripening that is attenuated by cool nights and great sunlight hours. So yeah, there's a lot of things fall into place here in Marlborough to grow phenomenal wines. Yeah.
And wine enthusiasts will be used to seeing reference made to pyrazines, to thiols in the context of Marlborough Sauvignon Blanc. For someone who knows the terminology but doesn't necessarily understand what that means, just explain how you can taste a pyrazine or taste a thiol.
I think pyrazines, methoxypyrazine, were instrumental in the beginning for really launching Sauvignon onto the world stage. It's a very fresh, green, herbaceous, pronounced character. They're very strong flavoured compounds and abundant here in Marlborough, and certainly in the early days. Thiols, the thiols that we're talking about, Much more tropical spectrum, tropical fruits, passion fruit, those kind of big, heady characters that are available in some of the riper offerings of Marlborough Sauvignon. So those are how I describe those.
Yeah, good description. Heather, talking of those kind of bigger, bolder flavours, that's absolutely part of the story here. But there has been a degree of evolution in the style of Sauvignon Blanc here in Marlborough, hasn't there?
Yeah, and I think as Stu was saying, a lot of those green characters would dominate in the early days. And that's partly to do with the soils that we grew the vines on to start with. And we've learned a lot about our region and the different sub-regions within Marlborough over time and adjusted our plantings accordingly. But now each wine company has their own style. The St. Clair style is probably more heading towards those tropicals. But I think the key to a wonderful Sauvignon Blanc, and this is where all producers in Marlborough are doing so well now, and this has evolved over time, is really getting a balance in those wines. So none of those flavours should dominate. They should all be in sort of harmony with each other. So you have a little bit of that capsicum tomato leaf element in there, the passion fruits and the black currants might sort of form the base for the wine, but also a nice sort of mineral note. I think Sauvignon Blancs from Marlborough often have a sort of a salty minerality to them, and particularly the St. Clair wines, we love those, and a lot of our vineyards are right by the ocean, so they get a little bit more of that, and that really gives that mouth-watering sort of character to Sauvignon Blanc that I think consumers ultimately really love. And so it's yeah, really understanding our wines, our vines, and just getting that balance in the wines and making them more sophisticated, I think.
Mm. And Stuart, I think Sauvignon Blanc is about 75% of what you do here. That means you obviously make other wines from other grape varieties. Tell us what else is exciting in Marlborough beyond Sauvignon.
There's a lot that is exciting in Marlborough. This is a great place to grow fruit. The cherries here are fantastic. But, you know, exciting here, you know, the Pinot Noir in Marlborough is world-class. The Chardonnay here is world-class. We grow phenomenal Riesling and Gewürztraminer. Cool climate, you know, coastal, just wonderful grape-growing region. Gruner Veltliner is new on the scene. Albarino, wonderful varieties that are just really thriving in a place like Marlborough.
Stuart McLennan and Heather Stewart, two of the winemaking team at St. Clair in Marlborough, and more about what Albarino might offer for the region later on. If you were to play a game of word association with Marlborough, chances are that Cloudy Bay would come next. First launched almost 40 years ago, it rapidly became an icon wine, and it's now part of LVMH, the Louis Vuitton Moët Hennessy family of brands, alongside the likes of Krug and Veuve Clicquot. Charged with maintaining the status of Cloudy Bay, chief winemaker Daniel Sorrell, I met him at the winery, and he began by recounting the incredible Cloudy Bay story.
It really came about almost by chance. David Honan, the founder of Cloudy Bay, was a winemaker and owner of a winery in Western Australia called Cape Mentelle. And back in 83, a couple of Kiwi winemakers were over there travelling around the Australian wine shows and really sort of, I guess, looking into how to make wine. It was fairly new to the New Zealand, the wine industry, and they ended up heading down to see and meet David Honan, and they were chatting about his wines, which predominantly were Bordeaux blends, a bit of Sauvignon Blanc and Semillon he was making out there, and they had a bottle of wine from New Zealand, Sauvignon Blanc in the boot, and they opened it up, and I've been told the hairs on the back of David's sort of neck rose, and he was blown away with this this wine, this aromatic intensity. It was something that he'd never experienced, seen, tasted before, and wanted to be, you know, part of that. And so he travelled to New Zealand, and back in those days, in 85, he somehow managed to convince the New Zealand government to be able to buy land and process some fruit here, and convince another English, actually, winemaker, Kevin Judd, to leave his job and Start Cloudy Bay, and the rest is history. But yeah, I think that moment that David saw something absolutely unique and different really was the thing that set New Zealand wine industry on its way. So,
and why do you think it is that this particular Sauvignon Blanc, the Cloudy Bay, why do you think it is that it's enjoyed such acclaim, such name recognition? Why has it been such an icon?
Where we grow Sauvignon Blanc, you can't grow, it's like Pinot. You can't grow it everywhere around the world. There's only a few select places that make really great Sauvignon Blanc, and Mulberry was one for definitely the style of Sauvignon Blanc. You can't grow it anywhere else. The soils, the terroir we talk about, it really is. This wine is made from the land. It's not winemaking. You have to have the special place, and Cloudy Bay, where David Honan first purchased the estate block, we haven't deviated for 35 years. We still source all our fruit in the Wairau. It makes a very distinctive Sauvignon Blanc compared to the other valleys, the Awatere or the Waihopai, and that is our DNA, that is the Wairau. So.
And you talk about that DNA, and clearly, as a winemaker, you will want to put your signature on a wine, and yet you're dealing with the DNA of a wine that is, in many respects, the crown jewels. How do you do that? How do you put your own stamp on something like Cloudy Bay, while at the same time being presumably very mindful that you don't want to do anything to the golden goose?
Oh, totally. At the end of the day, that wine is made, as I said, from the land. You're always going to be pushing boundaries. The guys that started Cloudy Bay, they took risks, big risks back in the days, and I think you only make better wines by taking risks. And we, as a team, are always trying to look. We have a little R&D winery here, and we're always trying different experiments every year. 9 times out of 10, they get flushed down the drain, but you find something, and then you evolve that. And we're always evolving the style of Cloudy Bay Sauvignon Blanc, but we do it slowly. It's always a 3-year project, and so you're moving that style without people really knowing, so you don't alienate the people that fell in love with that wine back 35 years ago. They're still, they're thinking they're getting that same bottle year and year. And there's always going to be a very Cloudy Bay signature when you open that bottle of wine.
Marlborough Sauvignon Blanc can be quite in your face. It is obviously very aromatic as a variety, and then the sense of place kind of heightens that experience. And yet, the wines, when I've tasted the new vintage each year, I think you're quite careful to have balance, an element of restraint there. Would that be fair?
Oh, totally. I think that is definitely Cloudy Bay's signature. We don't want to make just an aromatic fruit bomb. There has to be more, and even behind that, whether you're a wine connoisseur or not, you will definitely put your nose in the glass and go, it's Marlborough Sauvignon Blanc. But the more, I guess, you scratch under the surface, there's complexity, there's concentration, but there's elegance and refineness with that wine.
And that's a balancing act, I guess.
Yeah, we're lucky enough that we have these amazing vineyards to work with, and the guys put in a huge amount of effort. For us winemakers, it's quite easy. It's more white gloves on. We keep every batch separate, and then when we come to the blending bench, that really is what helps keep that DNA of Cloudy Bay, being able to put those last year, 97 different batches together. So it's great. And we get, you know, the luxury of working with LVMH. We don't have to make case makes. It's all about quality. So you'll always get the best from Cloudy Bay.
Mm. And it's interesting that I have a friend who thought that Cloudy Bay was one wine. I mean, the Sauvignon, such is its success that it's... it kind of rather dominates the portfolio, you could argue. Yet you're making quite a broad range of different wines here, aren't you?
Yeah, from day one. So the first wine was the Sauvignon, followed up the year after with a release of a Chardonnay. I think personally probably New Zealand's unsung hero. We make some amazing Chardonnays from the top to the bottom. We also make sparkling wine here. We've been making that for near on 36 years. Luckily, being again with LVMH, we can tap into some pretty amazing knowledge and really evaluate, express our terroir through Polaris, and I think we're making some pretty amazing sparkling wines there. And now we've got Pinot Noir as well. So we make a Pinot Noir from Marlborough and one from Central Otago.
And Marlborough, again, utterly synonymous with Sauvignon Blanc. But again, there's a lot more to Marlborough, isn't there?
Yeah, I think, you know, Marlborough, Sauvignon Blanc on the flats are fantastic. But if you go into the Southern Valleys, there's some amazing terroir for Pinot Noir, Chardonnay, the heavier soils. And some people are making some absolutely fantastic Chardonnay Pinot coming out of here. And there's other varietals that are starting to emerge, and I think that's fantastic. Marlborough will be hopefully known for more than just Sauvignon Blanc in years to come.
Cloudy Bay's Daniel Sorrell on his conviction that Marlborough means so much more than Sauvignon Blanc. A sentiment that would unquestionably be shared by Matt Thompson, a veteran winemaker and consultant who has completed two harvests in both hemispheres every single year since 1993. He co-founded Blank Canvas with his wife, Master of Wine Sophie Parker Thompson, a decade ago. And though they make wines around New Zealand, Blenheim is their base. He and Sophie are determined to put Marlborough on the map, quite literally, for its regional diversity. So I put it to him with some trepidation that many people might consider Marlborough to be a single place rather than somewhere with complex regional diversity.
Yeah, look, I think that's partly our fault as a winemaking region, as we've been very poor at telling the story. So as winemakers, you have all these batches of wine at the end of harvest, and you taste through them, you grade them, you allocate them. So we understand fully the nuances from the sub-regions, but we just haven't told that story.
Mm. And what's wrong with people just knowing Marlborough, full stop?
It's the same as any other great wine region. Like there are people who just want a Burgundy. There are other people who want a Chambertin. So I think it's the same level of detail. For those who want it, it should be available.
Mm. And what are you going to do about that then?
Well, we've started. It took us a long time, but we finally got together with a group of good friends, and we put together a wine map of Marlborough, and that's now available through AMW, Appalachian Marlborough Wine, very important organisation. And we were trying to create something that was good on the wall as well, because it needed to be up on walls and distribution offices and wine bars, like you see the great wine regions maps, because if you can't visit there, the map's the next best thing. You're going to see three macro regions. You're going to see the Wairoa Valley, which was the original planting, which is actually the largest valley in terms of area as well. And the tributary valleys of that are called the Southern Valleys, which are clay soils. And then south of that, you've got the Awatere Valley, which is the next biggest of the macro regions. Adjacent to that, you've got Blind River, which is a separate catchment. And then the third macro region is the southern coast, which represents a group of small valleys, and their streams discharge into the Pacific Ocean.
Mm. And what are we going to notice in terms of what's in the glass, in terms of difference between these sub-regions?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. I think when you're looking at those differences, you've really got to go into a bit more detail. I think the intensity of flavours, in my experience, tends to come from the coastal areas. So within 30 k's of the coast, I think you get the most diversity and intensity. So Dylan's point, which is very, very important for us at Blank Canvas, that produces very tropical characters, very intense characters, passion fruit, blackcurrant, and you always get a saltiness on the palate. And that salt's real. It's in the wines, it's in the soils. Sea View, I think, which is coastal arbitrary, I think you get a lot of powerful, crunchy herbs, snow pea, that kind of character, like essence of Sauvignon Blanc. If you go to the arbitrary, I think you get slightly higher acidity generally. Sea View is obviously part of the arbitrary, but the arbitrary in general, I think you do get a herbal element. Not an unattractive. I'm not talking green, if that makes sense, but mm-hmm. but definitely it's Sauvignon Blanc. Southern coast is very interesting. That limestone element means that those valleys can be quite different. They tend to be later generally. But in terms of detail, again, if you come back to the Wairoa Valley, I think the Stones, Condors Bend area, you get currant, you get black currant and white currant, some floral notes. Southern valleys, I think you're more citrus in characters, perhaps dialed back a little bit, which some people would prefer, I think. I'm not sure that everyone likes the full noise Sauvignon Blanc that comes from Alba. So I think you've got that diverse group of wines, which I think can please a lot of people. And I guess our dream about this map is that sommeliers worldwide are going to not have just one Sauvignon Blanc from Marlborough. They're not going to have just one thing on price. They're going to have a diverse range. And when someone says, I like a Marlborough Sauvignon Blanc, which we love to hear, by the way, the sommelier's going to respond and say, okay, what style do you like? And if it's the crunchy herbal note, then maybe Sea View. If it's the tropical passion fruit notes, then maybe it's Dylan's Point. Citrus, perhaps Southern Valleys, perhaps Bone River as well, that's also citrus. So I think it's giving people the tools to understand that. And if you think of it from a consumer point of view, if you dial into what you like, you can ask for those wines and get more hits in the zone that you really enjoy.
Marlborough Sauvignon Blanc is a massive sort of smash hit, and yet it's also something that inspires some kind of adverse reaction, some snobbery from certain wine consumers. Is what you're talking about doing aimed at sort of countering some of that snobbery too?
Look, absolutely. I think when I hear people say, oh, it all tastes the same, I think you just don't really know enough. And again, I don't necessarily blame those people, because I don't think as a region we've explained it very well. And that map is a very important step in giving people a tool to understand that it's not all the same. Mm. So snobbery, yeah, look. I think you always get that. And I think you always get people knocking success. New Zealand's particularly good at that. Mm. But I think it is an incredibly successful, arguably the most successful New World wine region. Mm. So you're always going to get the knockers. I think the challenge for us is to make sure that our quality is maintained. And that's where RMW comes in, to try and campaign and set standards that our members embrace.
Mm. The other challenge you have is that your main product, Sauvignon Blanc, is so successful that it kind of obliterates knowledge of other varietals here. Is that something else you could do something about through this sort of knowledge process?
Absolutely. Look, if you understand the soil types, you understand how we can do different things in different places. Now, for me, possibly the worst place to plant Pinot Noir, in our view, is the best place to plant Sauvignon Blanc, and that's Dylan's point. I have made Pinot Noir from down there, and it's not something I'd like to repeat personally. So it's crucial. Those soil types are so important. It is frustrating that we are pigeonholed, that soil diversity gives us the opportunity to make great Pinot and great Chardonnay. And occasionally we're recognised for that, but too often consumers go looking elsewhere for those two varieties.
Matt Thompson of Blank Canvas. And if you'd like to look at that detailed map of Marlborough in all its regional diversity, then head to the Appellation Marlborough Wine website, appellationmarlboroughwine.co.nz, where you'll find a version to click on and zoom into and all the rest. And you can also learn more about the other varieties that shine, albeit in the shadow of its hero grape, Sauvignon Blanc, which accounts for the overwhelming majority of the wines produced. I caught up with Natalie Christensen at Yealands, the chief winemaker there, to talk about the future for Marlborough and how its wines are evolving.
Well, from what I've seen, I do quite a lot of wine show judging. The wines that are getting awarded and people are sort of moving towards seem to be the slightly more restrained styles. So less in that full-blown fruity tropical spectrum and more sort of searching for, a little bit more kind of restraint on the nose, potentially like a little something a bit herbal, a bit salty, but yeah, beautiful purity and purity of fruit and beautiful texture. So, yeah, I think there's been a general shift, especially kind of in that top end of Marlborough Sauvignon, to more elegant, refined textural styles of Sauvignon.
And when you're seeking to achieve that in your own wines, which you clearly looking to do because that's reflected in those wines, how are you achieving that?
I think a big part of it is site selection and where your vineyards are placed. But I also think that we've been chasing those, what we as winemakers call thiols, which are those very tropical, vibrant sort of characters. And there are definitely, different yeasts that you can use and, sort of different techniques that you can do in the vineyard to not necessarily chase those as much.
And the result is something that's just a bit more dialed back.
Yeah, less in those sort of full-blown fruit flavours and more in the kind of textural restrained profile.
Mm. And a Marlborough, we tend to think of it as a place. And of course, it's massive. it's a load of different places. So do you think individual sites are going to play a much bigger role in the story of Marlborough in the future?
I think so. I mean, there's been a lot of work done recently about there's what's known as the Marlborough map and talking about the sub-regionality of Marlborough. I mean, I'm a bit biased. I obviously work with a lot of fruit from the Awatere Valley and especially our Seaview Vineyard, which is right on the coast in the Awatere Valley. And definitely the profile we get there is very powerful wines, but there's a beautiful elegance and texture to them. And they're not necessarily hugely sort of showy aromatically up front, but there's beautiful greens and herbals coming through. But definitely a beautiful kind of chalky minerality through the palate that I love.
Yeah. Mm. And are we going to see more and more fine wines, premium end wines coming from Marlborough, do you think?
Well, it's interesting. Like, I've been spending time a little bit in some of our sort of international markets, and like what's currently selling, there seems to be at that top end, wines are still selling, and at the very bottom end, wines are still selling. But it's sort of that middle space where wines are still selling, but there's been a bit of a slow slope in the market. So, yeah, I think that producers are definitely, be focusing hopefully on that high end, because that seems to be people are spending more money but buying less wine these days. So I think that's a smart place to put your attention. But obviously you can't put all your product into that space because it's still quite a limited space. Mm. So, yeah, it's a tricky kind of time, I guess, but that seems to be what's happening out there in the market.
Yeah, and Marlborough's not just about Sauvignon Blanc, of course, anyway. You are partly by dint of where you learnt to make wine, you are a massive champion for
Albarino, aren't you?
Yeah, no, I love Albarino. So, yeah, before working at Yealand's, which was probably about 10 or 11 years ago now, I was living in Galicia in Spain when Rías Baixas making Albarino. And, yeah, we've got some here out at CB Vineyard at Yealand's. And there's definitely, over the last 10 years, actually been a bit of a bloom in producers making Albarino in New Zealand. And, yeah, I think it's great. And I think it's a variety that... it's not necessarily a transition from Sauvignon Blanc, but it's got beautiful acidity and it's a variety that's very, I guess it's kind of fashionable right now, but I think it's more than fashion. I think it's a style of wine with that vibrancy and that there is there's that beautiful, fresh, crisp acidity that I think that style of wine people are enjoying at the moment. Yeah, I just think it's a style of wine that it's easily picked up and easily enjoyed, and I think there'll be a growing market for that.
Mm. And we're standing looking at the sea, looking at vines by the sea. I mean, it's a grape variety. If you think of it as coming from Galicia, this is a natural home for that grape variety, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm very pleased and excited with the style of Albarino that we're creating from our vineyard. And it's not exactly like the Saunier's Valley in Spain. Obviously, the vines I was working with were right on the coast of, the Atlantic. Yeah, no, it does have similarities. Like, we definitely have that kind of hallmark of a sort of a subtle saltiness through the wines that we make at Seaview. And that subtle saltiness is definitely a hallmark and, classic Albarino from Rías Baixas.
Natalie Christensen on the future for Albarino. And that's just one of the varieties that now thrives in Marlborough, a region that of course warrants recognition for its storming success with Sauvignon Blanc. But it also deserves much more attention as one of the world's most exciting and dynamic wine regions.
The Drinking Hour with David Kermode in partnership with Club Onologique, the world through the lens of wine and spirits.
Well, let's round off as always with some medal winners from the IWSC Hall of Fame in 2023. And all of our selection, including four golds, come from Marlborough. You guessed it. Yealand's Reserve Sauvignon Blanc 2022 from Natalie's stable, of course, won a strong gold medal with a whopping 97 points. Here's the tasting note. Classic in style with a very intense, zingy, lifted nose with aromas of grass and herbs. Crisp palate, leafy with some passion fruit and guava notes. Benchmark style with genuine intensity and depth. An impressive length and purity on the finish. The judging here overseen by Dersiu Viana Jr., MW, and the panel, Fiona Hayes, Piotr Petras, MS, and Philip Tuck, MW. And also landing a gold with 95 points from the same panel, St. Clair Family Estate, Origin Sauvignon Blanc 2022 from Stuart and Heather, who we heard at the start. The judges said about this wine, very impressive concentration here with good depth and enticing complexity. Citrus, grassy and melon notes on the nose. The palate is lean with citrus and green apple. The acidity is zesty and saline and good concentration and length. Very refreshing, they said. Well, we heard about the huge potential for Chardonnay in Marlborough, and that's reflected in the gold medal table. I was on the judging panel for the next one, alongside Ray O'Connor MW and Piotr Petras MS. Giessen Organic Chardonnay 2019 got a gold with 95 points. The tasting note, complex and concentrated nose of fresh pineapple and plump ripe pears, with an intense and powerful palate of tart tatin, white almonds and spiced cloves. It has a creamy texture with lovely balance and poise before a concentrated, polished, lingering finish. And here's another gold medal-winning Chardonnay from Marlborough. Marisco Vineyards, the Craft Series, the Pioneer Chardonnay 2021. The judges described a rich expression of baked apple and smoky complexity with toasty notes and a distinctively mineral-driven slate edge. complex and concentrated, unfurling to candied hints of vanilla and layered integrated oak over an impressively powerful and freshly acidic lifted finish. And finally, we heard at the end about the potential for Albarino. Natalie, very much a champion for the variety, and so she'll be chuffed with this from, I think, the launch year for this wine. Yeelands Estate Single Vineyard Albarino 2022 won a strong silver with 93 points, just shy of a gold. I was on the panel for this one too. We said this, an expressive nose of peaches and cream, swirled with orange blossom and a touch of underlying salinity. The palate is fresh with tropical fruits and a lively citrus finish. Well, talking of finishes, that's it for this edition from Marlborough. My thanks to all those who generously gave me their time, and thanks to you for listening. Coming soon, we'll zoom in on Hawke's Bay on the North Island, of course. But next week, it's the turn of Hannah Crosby talking about her new book, Corked. Looking forward to that. Until then, goodbye.
The Drinking Hour with David Kermode, in partnership with Club Onologique. The world through the lens of wine and spirits.
To find out more about Food FM and our content, go to foodfmradio.com.